Bible points out. Points out that as far as it's possible to judge, he was a man of extraordinarily humble and rather frightened personality. As against this is the tremendous strength of the thing that he did. The Hijrah, which was the great flight of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina, which had resulted in the saving of his life because his enemies were determined to destroy him, is the beginning of the Muslim era. And all dates in the Muslim world are calculated AH, or the year of the Hijrah, rather than AD as we count time. Muhammad's life, after the creation of his ministry and its development, centers very largely upon the principles of his faith, principles which to him were so real and so promising and so valuable that no one would dare to question them. Probably there is no other monotheism in the world as strict or as austere as the faith of Islam. It was a faith based upon Muhammad's own famous statement, "There is no God but God." He rejected totally the Trinitarianism of Christianity. He rejected totally the incarnation of God as Christ. He did not, however, reject Jesus. He declared Jesus to be the greatest of the prophets. And in the Quran, he says that anyone who does not believe that Jesus, the Son of Mary, was a prophet sent from God, shall no way enter heaven. He believed in Jesus, but he believed also of Jesus as of himself, that God has no sons except all men, that God has no personal children, but that God is able to move in the hearts of men so that some become his servants. And those who dedicate their lives totally to the service of God and are rewarded by the divine presence, they are the prophets. Muhammad said all prophets are human. All prophets are men reaching up to God. All prophets are teachers, but their flesh and their body is the same as the flesh of any other man. That some may gain great reputation and be remembered forever because they have served men well. But no matter how great their reputation, regardless of the fact that future ages may deify them, there is only God and man, and all men are the servants of God. Therefore, all men are potentially prophets. All men have a tremendous possible mission, and those who answer the call of the Spirit in themselves, they are the ones who become the instruments of God's will. But regardless of this, these same human beings are not infallible, because through them also is their own humanity. And the man who may speak with the voice of God in one sentence may speak with his own voice in the next and not know which is which. Therefore, all men are mortal. If there is anything good in them, follow it. If there is anything bad in them, forgive it and pass on. This peculiar faith was so dramatic in its way that it certainly had a tremendous effect upon the Near East. Politically and psychologically, there is nothing to indicate that Muhammad ever expected his religion to be more than a positive reform. He had come again in a strange way, not to destroy prophets, but to fulfill them. He accepted the prophets of the Old Testament. He accepted the teachings of Jesus. He recognized the ministry of the apostles. He believed that these were all great and good human beings serving God, and as such entitled to the enduring respect of all men. At last, at the head of a great company of people, he returned to Mecca, bearing as his standard the green veil of his wife on a pole. He placed this in the court of the Kaaba, destroyed the ancient idols, and rededicated it to Allah, the one God. He then also redeemed or restated the old pilgrimage. He created at Mecca a new religious center. He cleaned the temple to the very best of his ability. He placed such rules upon the people of Mecca on a religious level that they could no longer exploit each other. He also then established the great pilgrimage to Mecca. And those who made the pilgrimage had a twist of green foil placed upon their turbans to indicate that they had gone to the holy city. Also, Muhammad made Jerusalem second only to Mecca as a center of religious worship. He continued his life, his ministry. His death was ultimately the result of poison. An effort was made to poison him. As he placed the cup to his lips, the hand of Jabariel appeared and knocked it from his hand in the presence of a company of people. But he had already taken a very small amount of the contents of the cup, and it is said to have gradually killed him. He lived for several years in weakening health. The year before his death, he made the last great pilgrimage to Mecca on the feast of Ramadan. This time he was too feeble to walk, and he rode upon a great black camel. At the head, it is said, of 60,000 of the faithful, who went there to re-vow and rededicate themselves to the one God who is in heaven and earth and in the souls of men. And on this great black camel, he made his last speech, his last talk to his people. He told them he would not come back again. He told them that they were to remember always that as a man of themselves he had lived, and as a man he died, that he had no virtues beyond their own, that he was no more important than any one of them. There was only one thing important in all the world, and that was God. And there was only one way that men could serve God, and that was with truth. That these things alone were real, and that they were never to glorify him, never to sanctify him, and he forbade that they should have a likeness of him in their world. No portrait, no likeness, no picture. They were to remember him only as a man of Mecca who had lived with them, worked with them, walked with them, died with them. These things, undoubtedly, to the Arabian mind, were tremendously important. And this very severe, very just kind of faith, built upon a triangular foundation, undoubtedly, partly Judaism, partly Christianity, and partly the peculiar synthesis accomplished within the consciousness of this man himself. This faith had a tremendous lasting effect. But what happened to it? Exactly the same thing that happened in the church councils of early Christianity. Through the caliphs, through the development of the great descendants of the prophet, through his daughter Fatima, the entire faith fell again into the same strange mysteries of organization, the same strange struggle for temporal power, all of the factors. Carlyle tells us that in spite of all the lurid stories that we hear, it is doubtful if Muhammad ever held a sword in his hand. He did not have a warlike nature. Also, he did not, as many believe, take a very unpleasant attitude or a restricted Muslim attitude toward women. During his own day and for centuries thereafter, woman's state in Arabia was exactly equal to that of man. These things came in gradually, narrowing and restricting a belief through interpretation, perhaps even through false translation. Those purposes which human beings themselves most desired to attain gradually took over until the simple faith of the man was lost in the confusion of the rise of a great creed. So we have this pattern dated at approximately the year 600. Now this pattern in itself had almost immediate repercussions. In the first place, it became one of the bitterest situations that the rising Christian church in Europe had to face. Here was something that to them was little better than a blasphemy. Not only were the creedal problems prominent, but here was another religion rising. A religion in a world which Christianity had believed to be dedicated to the cross. A powerful religion arising from the ashes of decadent faiths and threatening immediately the boundaries of Christendom itself. From this moment on, Christianity in Europe had an enemy. Now, this enemy, more or less originally self-created, but ultimately a very real and terrible adversary, this enemy did two things to Christianity. Like all adversity, it strengthened. It forced Christianity almost immediately to proceed in its own integration. It had to forget much. It had to mend broken bridges. It had to attempt to restore lost friendships. It had to take into account the great need for unity. This is exampled in the early rise of the Holy Roman Empire, where the church, perhaps more in fear of rising Islam than any other equation, began the powerful problem, faced the powerful problem of reorganizing its entire isolated position, fitting itself into a pattern involving a great deal more diplomacy and government than had previously been intended. Islam also began to spread in other directions. Islam spread into and attacked the boundaries of the Byzantine or Eastern Empire. Islam moved into the Far East through the great passes of Afghanistan and Khyber. It moved through the Valley of the Sindh in India. It reached not only into the innermost parts of India, but on past India into China. It reached downward into the Dutch East Indies. It reached into every part of Asia. Probably the only area that was not greatly affected by it was Japan. In this tremendous outreaching, Islam in its spread began the consolidation of a great Muslim empire, a Muslim empire that remained until the rise of such men as Akbar the Great, the Muslim empire which made possible the advent of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, or Timur Shah. An empire which bound together an area many times the size of Christianity and bound it together under one of the most powerful religious forces man has ever known. You may note that not long ago there was an article in the paper about the young heir to the lands, estates, and titles of the Aga Khan. This young man is, I believe, studying in America, or was in England at one time, but he is studying in Western schools for the purpose of gradually taking over administration of a large body, many million Muslims. This young man is said to be most personable, a fine chap with a wonderful sense of humor and very modern, with many, many Western interests. He is in a Western college with friends of American, English, European background. He moves with them in complete adjustment, and yet this young man will not take a drink because he is a Muslim. Now, this type of thing is hard for us to understand, perhaps, but a true Muslim will not. There has never been an alcohol problem in the real Muslim world. Why? Because it is prohibited by the Quran. Not long ago, a traffic snarl in Hejaz, or what is now Saudi Arabia. No one knew who was right. The policeman came along, listened to all the stories, took out the Quran, and solved the problem. Everything moves from the Quran. If you do not know what to do, read the Quran. And if it isn't in the Quran, don't do anything. But one thing, you must never go against it. And that is as true today as it was 1,400 years ago. So the tremendous power and integrity of this faith in the lives of its people, we cannot say has produced in all cases an admirable people, but it has produced a very strong, united attitude by means of which the moral influence of Islam is far greater than its political. Islam, unlike Christianity, has never had a central church. Islam has never had its equivalent of a pope, nor has it ever had its equivalent of a college of cardinals. It has had nothing of this kind. Your Islamite is ruled by the descent of the caliphate. It is ruled by families tracing their descendants from the prophet. And as the only surviving heir of the prophet was his daughter, they all descend from the descent of Fatima. This family descent produces a number of rulers ruling over Muslim states. It was the secret of the authority of the Aga Khan. He was a direct descendant of the Prophet. All the descendants of the Prophet, therefore, have a kind of priestly influence of their own, ruling their own sects, ruling groups and schools. But these themselves, these leaders, never find it necessary, or never have, to have any powerful religious political structure. Therefore, in Islam, there is no such a thing as one moving political power. Efforts have been made to synchronize Islam and synthesize its factions by what has been called the rise of pan-Islamism, or the pan-Islamic movement, but it has taken very few roots. The Muslim remains an individualist. The Muslim priest is also quite different from our concept of a priest, because he is not actually a priest at all. The Muslim priest is a teacher. He is more of what we would call a schoolmaster. He performs certain religious functions, but his essential reason for existence is the instruction of the young. Therefore, the school in Islam was on the steps of the mosque, and here reading, writing, and arithmetic were taught by the so-called priest. He calls the faithful to prayer. He may lead them in prayer. He may read certain verses of the Quran, but it's always to be remembered in Islam that it is the believer himself who is the priest. If the believer himself is not sincere, no priest can save him. If the believer himself is not sanctified, no ritual, no sacrament can sanctify him. Everything must happen within himself. He must spread the rug of prayer, and when he gets upon it, means that he leaves this world and enters into a sanctuary, the sanctuary of his own life. He then faces Mecca, the great seat of his faith, the great center of his belief. And he recites his eternal prayer, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, there is no God but God. This situation has importance to us today, and it also had very great importance at the time which we mention, because it resulted almost immediately in the integration of a great policy in Europe. From the date of the life of Muhammad, from the rise of the immediate caliphs after Muhammad, we see Europe suddenly taking stock of itself. Europe had passed through many important changes. It had seen the Roman Empire collapse, and now it looked, for a moment at least, as though it was going to see the Holy Roman Empire collapse. It was seeing a tremendously vital faith, a faith moved by the most amazing strength of the desert. And this faith growing, gathering like a whirlwind beyond the ramparts of Gog and Magog, and threatening to inundate Europe like a tidal wave. It is quite probable, although most historians have only intimated it, it is most probable that the thing that brought Europe out of its own doldrums was Islam. Not because Europe was interested or delighted, but because Europe saw handwriting on the wall of the desert. Europe realized the fact that it was faced with something that was going to require a lot of thinking, and several interesting points present themselves as comparison when we begin studying this situation. We find in the rising power of Islam a tremendous rise of culture. Within a very short time, the faith of Islam was in the keeping of perhaps the most brilliant group that existed west of deep Asia. The caliphs of Baghdad, the great leaders of the Muslim movements, gathered around themselves magnificent courts. They created a tremendous civilization, a civilization of intangibles, but very real values. Theirs was a civilization of philosophy, of science, of poetry, of music, and of art, and the most skillful and wonderful of crafts. Because of the peculiar quoting of their scripture, for instance, the Muslim world was free from something that laid a heavy hand upon Europe, and that was the restriction upon learning and the danger that the Western European was constantly fearing that he was going to fall into religious heresy. The Muslim never had this. The Muslim could study Plato or study Aristotle or anything of that kind without any qualm of conscience at all, because he was not under the strange orthodoxy that held Christendom in its grasp for centuries. Thus the Muslim expanded, he grew, but most of all he became a highly civilized person. And we were not to find that out for a long while, and most of Europe did not know it until the Crusades. But there was rising a golden empire of attainments. And in this empire was supported progress in Europe for centuries. For it was the return of the golden empire of classical learning to Europe through the later founding of the Moorish universities in Spain under Muslim control that Europe finally came out of the Dark Ages and entered into the more luminous period which we call the Renaissance. Now it's interesting to realize for a moment even how this happened. When the Moorish universities, which were Islamic and which stemmed in part at least from the Holy House of Cairo, When these universities were opened in Spain, what do we learn? We learn that scholars of every belief went to them. We find the Christian scholar, the Jewish scholar, the Muslim scholar studying side by side. The Muslim never restricted learning to his own sect. He opened it to anyone who wanted it. To him, reading, writing, and arithmetic were not matters of religion. They were matters of common need. And all men were entitled to them equally. The Muslims did a great deal in algebra and in optics. And they gave us many choice formulas. They gave us many secrets of medicine long lost. They opened the way for the rise of humanism in Europe. And they gradually transformed European education. For we find that the European graduates of the Muslim colleges in Spain went back to Europe. And there at the Sapienza and in the great universities of Europe, they had the chairs of authority. So a tremendous bridge was built all the time behind the surface of great antagonism. And yet Europe needed what the Muslim had so badly, Europe had to accept it. All this is a very involved situation. But out of it we see several things gradually emerging. We see the political restoration of Europe gradually in its union against the danger of a rising Muslim world. We find the infiltration of Muslimism into nearly all other parts of Asia. We find also another interesting thing, namely that Muslim schools, Muslim universities, Muslim communities also became the refuges for two kinds of people. One, persecuted heretical Christians, and second, persecuted Jewish scholars. The Jewish scholar found his refuge in Baghdad and among the Muslim states. He was able to pursue his cultural life and pursue his studies of medicine and science, which greatly concerned him at this period. He also found the only tolerant area in Europe, in Spain, where he was able to advance his educational processes until Alfonso of Castile, gradually coming into possession and overthrowing the Muslim schools, began the process of exiling Jewish scholars. But for centuries, the Jewish scholar also was able to gain a broader education and to advance his learning. All these factors played their parts. Muslimism, furthermore, became a bridge between the Far East and Europe. It's one thing that has always happened with mankind. Regardless of how much he dislikes anyone, he will do business with him. Business is entirely outside of the province of your prejudices. Europe was in desperate need of products, or thought it was at least, which were available only along the caravan routes from the Muslim world through Samarkand and through all these areas of the Near East. It was from the Near East, therefore, that the caravans from the Far East finally reached Europe, and goods and communication from Europe finally reached Asia. So Muslimism, seated at the crossroads of the world, of the then existing known world, was in a most fortuitous condition. It could control and regulate for its own advantage practically all the traffic between Asia and Europe. And this traffic was much heavier than we realize. It was along these routes that paper came, enabling us to follow the Eastern habit and practice of books. It was from these same traffic routes also later that the secret of printing came, finally to be rediscovered by Gutenberg. All these trade routes also had much to do with the common knowledge of scholars. In the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, Chinese scholars penetrated all the way to Europe along the trade routes. And we have far better understanding of international relationships as a result of this than people generally realize. Unfortunately, however, the understanding was limited to a few families, to a few persons who were in position to receive or secure this information. The general public, of course, at that time was abysmally ignorant. Thus, in this great cycle of the Phoenix, we see the challenges that were to affect a great many things. Strangely enough, when the bird spread his wing again, we had a new religion, a powerful one, springing up as Muhammad himself originally intended it to be, as a censoring force upon Christianity. It was almost certain that Muhammad hoped, although never perhaps was certain, that his faith would help people to reevaluate Christianity in the light of working together for one God and forgetting creeds. That was the thing he was working for. Of course, he did not succeed in this, but he did produce the adversary who was so real and so increasing in power that men had to take it seriously. And thus, we find then a gradual change in the total picture of European thought. And the Dark Ages began to move into what we term the medieval world. And the medieval world was the direct result of the impact of decadent Europe and the Near East. Now, what is the difference between the Dark Ages and the medieval world? Today, most historians prefer to refer to the whole period as the medieval world, extending from the 5th to about the 12th centuries. They like to only consider the term Dark Ages as relatively applied to the critical turning point at the beginning of this period. By the medieval world, they understand the world of the gradual building of European institutions. Up to the collapse of the Roman Empire, Rome had been a single powerful unit and had gradually captured, colonized, and formed into various kinds of semi-autonomous groups, the nations that paid tribute to Rome. Now the process of the gradual integration of nations began to take place. The rise during the medieval world was the rise of societies, of what we would term petty states. And the great product of the medieval period was what we call feudalism. Now, feudalism was the return of local government from Rome to various petty princes, nobles, squires, and so on, who were liberated from Rome. They set themselves up as crested and liberated gentry, built themselves castles, became proprietors of the lands around these castles, lived off of the taxes which they collected from the land allotments of their tenants, and slowly developed into what we term aristocracy. Now, there were good things and there were bad things about this. The first thing is, something had to happen, so it had to follow some line of least resistance. The Romans had placed puppets, or had variously influenced local persons to be sort of quislings for the Roman purposes in these distant regions. These puppets, in some cases, were able to maintain themselves, take over, and become the early feudal rulers. Others were overcome by more ambitious associates. New lines were established. But little by little, Europe developed into a mass of these small feudal units. Some of them cut through language, although language became one of the few barriers that separated them. They were also with one common denominator. All these little feudal lords held their authority by the grace of God. They were all united in religion, and were to a measure at least held in check by the fear of religious retaliation. Most of these feudal princes and lords had their theological advisors, and these tried to keep them in line, and many times did so. And the general tone of this religious advice was generally good, generally inclined for fairness or toward clemency or leniency on all matters other than theological. So these petty princes began to form a powerful group. And the Middle Ages really is the story of the struggle of these various rulers, sometimes in subterfuge, sometimes in war. Out of this also rose another situation which we refer to as the Age of Chivalry. And the Age of Chivalry, again, was a revolt against feudalism. The Age of Chivalry was the recognition of the dawn of a common rulership. The Age of Chivalry was a kind of over-religion, a religion attempting to correct the faults of theology. Feudalism continued until these various feudal princes became highly decadent. So the story of feudalism extends through that cycle of the Phoenix, which extends from the 6th to the 12th century. And after the 12th century, feudalism was stricken with a mortal blow from which it never recovered. In other words, men becoming free of Rome, becoming free, period. These men began to abuse freedom. The rights that had been gained to individual peoples by the collapse of the Roman colonial program, these rights began to be abused. Little by little, freedom became the right of license. By degrees, the individual, increasing in selfishness, lost sight of the essential values of human life. These feudal princes and lords were too ignorant even to know what was going on in the world around them, with the exception of a few outstanding examples. They lived only to exploit, by degrees, their tenants. Under some conditions, taxation reached such points that the tenants themselves could no longer survive. Also, this system meant that there could be no unification in Europe. Each one of these knights sitting in his castle on the top of a hill with his retainers was a power unto himself. He could not be forced to do anything. He would not sacrifice any of his own rights. He would not cooperate, and it was at this time that began the great cycle of suspicion which has divided Europe ever since. No man trusted anyone. There was no probability or possibility of any common relationship. You could not even get roads. There was no communication that was valid. Practically all communication simply consisted of the personal runners of these knights. The only road that ever led away from a feudal castle led to Rome. There was practically no other perspective. Rome was a kind of hub, and this vast feudalism moved around it. The feudalism was not good for Rome. It was not good for the feudal lords themselves, nor for their peoples. yet it arose as the direct result of man's first massive abuse of freedom. He had received it too soon. The overseer had departed, but had left an ignorant man behind him, incapable of governing his own destiny. This, of course, led, as it would naturally do, to a series of moves, of brilliant moves, but of highly selfish ones. Those feudal groups, more powerful than others, began to move in upon their neighbors. By degrees, the smaller and weaker were crushed out, and by degrees, the domains of the greater families increased. This meant that also during this period, Europe gradually changed into a series of family rulerships, which would become, or were to be, the beginning of the monastic, not monastic, but monarchical concept. Gradually, the little principalities were absorbed, and out of them all came finally a handful, less than 50 perhaps, great families. Families with deep and some of them rather terrible reputations, like the Borgia and the Medici. These families became the virtual dictators of the earth, as far as Europe was concerned. And beneath the surface of this procedure, the state of man was growing worse and worse and worse. This condition could only again lead to ultimate violence. But here we have a pattern that was to revive itself again in another cycle later. The coming together of these feudal lords into the formation of great families began to develop a psychology which developed as early as the 6th century and has continued in some places even to the present time. But today we are also beginning to recognize the danger of this pattern, although we have believed it ourselves until very recently, because these old ideas do not die easily. The only one who can get over them quickly is the astute historian, who, seeing what they did before, hopes he will never live to see it happen again. But the point that I mean is this: out of this entire procedure rose the first rugged individualism. During the great glory of the feudal system, we have no evidence whatsoever that human beings accepted any responsibility for the well-being of each other. That is an almost unbelievable condition. The first rise against that was the orders of chivalry. It was the concept of chivalry, probably created by secret societies, was the first to break through this. And the struggle of chivalry against it has given us the Arthurian cycle and many of the great literary epics, which are somewhat later in their date than the stories which they describe, because early these stories were based upon previous legendary. But actually, in Europe at that time, there was no concept of mutual responsibility. There was no consciousness of the relationship of events. The Middle Ages were the Middle Ages because they were totally without historical perspective. Nobody believed that anything that happened was due to any reason, nor would any inevitable consequence result from anything he did. One of his troubles, of course, was that he had gotten himself completely out of the picture, and fate, destiny, deity had taken over all the aspects of human morality. If a man dropped dead, it was by the grace of God, not because he had eaten something that made him sick. If he didn't have a friend, it was because God was punishing him, not because he'd never earned a friend. If a plague swept through a great community, it was the work of the Lord, and no one thought of hygiene or sanitation. If a man declared war, regardless of whether his cause was right or wrong, it was by the grace of God, and the underlings had to just simply go out and die. There was no concept that individuals had to work together, or that the building of a civilization depended upon perspective. No one at that time thought of sacrificing his own little feudal castle to build a better world, or sacrificing any part of it. He had no sense of a different world. Now, there were several reasons why he didn't. One of these reasons was the plague. And the plague was such an extraordinary factor that it cut through every equation of man. One visit of the bubonic plague in Europe resulted in 29 million deaths. The deaths were so terrible and so constant that the Pope blessed the waters of the River Seine in France so that the sanctified dead could be buried by being thrown into the river because there was no longer any place in the cemeteries for them. Also, in the cemeteries of Paris, due to the number of bodies put in, the level of the cemetery ground rose 20 feet in 1 year. On some of the smaller islands, such as, for example, the island of Malta, in one of the epidemics, it is said that not one human being was left alive. This situation, psychologically, was completely demoralizing, and the plague struck Europe at least 9 times. With tremendous devastation, some of the attacks being only 5 or 10 years apart. This was completely a factor with which no man at that time could conceive that he could reckon. Therefore, no man could plan. No man could purpose anything. Here today, gone tomorrow. He never knew why, and he never knew when. And if the plague didn't get him, the feudal lord would send him off to some remote place to fight and die. So there was no integration, no purpose behind the pattern of life. The second thing was that it was generally assumed at that time, theologically, that the world would end before the 12th century. Therefore, if the second coming, the end of the world, were to occur, perhaps even in your own lifetime, and you believed this completely, you could see that there would be very little probability of social planning. It just didn't occur. There was no reason for it. Everything was in the hands of fate and destiny. Everything was completely apart from man. All he could do was serve and die. There was no possible thought that he should leave much to his children, for he had nothing to leave them. Even assuming that he did leave them something, he might very well find that they would predecease him. There was no reason to make better ground or plant a better harvest, because the man up in the castle on the hill took it away from you anyway. The whole thing settled down, and we have the record, definitely, that Europe passed for centuries through what might be termed a collective hopelessness. Now, you might say that the feudal lord was in a pretty fortunate position at this time, but he wasn't. Actually, he had no more perspective than the people, because the only way in which you can have perspective is to be better, and he was no better. He was not really a bad man. He was stupid, and so were the people, and there was no cure. There were no schools for him to go to. He lived alone. His principal sports were hunting and war. He had no reason to believe that war meant anything. He wasn't fighting for anything except to hold on to what he had. He had no reason to expect loyalty except that the bishop or the priest had taught that obedience to the Lord of the castle was second only to obedience to the Lord in heaven. The bishop didn't know any better. He wasn't a selfish, bad man. It was simply a locked world, a world of illiterates, a world of people who had suddenly gotten into a situation much too large for them. And the growing pains, which we call the Middle Ages or the medieval period, were certainly painful to everyone involved, the rich and the poor alike. The Doge of Venice was just as likely to die of smallpox as the poorest farmer. In fact, he usually was the first to go, because the man on the farm lived close to the earth and certain natural sanitation protected him. The man in the castle on the hill was in much worse condition from the standpoint of sanitation. Even as late as Queen Elizabeth of England, Elizabeth I, The Queen herself made a tremendous stir in London when she declared that regardless of heaven or hell, scriptures or authority, she was going to take a bath once a year. For hundreds of years, people were told that to take a bath was to get the plague. You can see how such a situation would fit rather tight and would also prevent any directing of progress. With this also was this terrible fear. Now, if the common man had nothing to hope for and perhaps was too ignorant to have any integrated fear, the few leaders who did have a little background knew two things, as one or two of them preserved for us in historical records. First, they realized how little they could depend upon ignorant followers. That was a serious situation in itself. A leader is no stronger than his followers. And where he is dealing with a group of people completely unlettered, unlearned, and highly superstitious, he is not in a safe position. On the other hand, his broader experience whispered to him that Islam was right around the corner. And he sat very uneasily upon his higher seat. All this elevation permitted him to do was to see his dangers a little more readily. So he had worries that the common man never knew, but they were worries just the same. To meet this situation with its tremendous neurosis, you can see why something else would occur. You could see why the mind of Europe would slowly go into what you might term a complete psychoneurotic condition. And it was the psychoneurosis of the European mind that gave rise to another horrible situation that grew, and that was demonism. Now, we don't have any idea today what demonology did to Europe. We have a little taste of what it did in the Salem witchcraft scare in this country. But that was an isolated incident, and common sense very soon came to the assistance of everyone involved. In a few years, the situation was cleared up. But in Europe, we had 500 years of demonism. We had 500 years of people who didn't dare to go out of the house at night. People who firmly believed that the devil was under every pew in church, even while they were praying. A people who believed their neighbors went up the chimney on broomsticks. A people who firmly believed that thousands of their so-called honest fellow citizens rode on broomsticks to the Bracken to celebrate the Sabbath and to dance in frenzy around the strange, grotesque figure of the Goat of Mendes. Now, this was a cheerful situation. Well, what did it do? It made every person afraid of his neighbor. It made people so frightened that when old Dr. Faust had a dog that could stand on its hind legs, he was accused of being a witch or a sorcerer. And a dog that would answer when his master whistled was a devil in disguise. You couldn't even have a dog that answered when you whistled. Cows, rats, cats, and everything else brought into court and tried for heresy. Horses burned at the stake. And if you don't believe that hysteria of this kind could do things, see what happens in a lynching in the South today. So-called respectable, honorable citizens lose their minds temporarily. And in Europe, remember, at that time, men didn't have much mind to lose. And it went easily and quickly. We had millions of persons murdered, executed, tortured to death for this terrible fear. We had the malus maleficarum, the hammer of evil, which, like the mallet in the hands of a justice or a chairman, came down with a blow every time a man was condemned to death. So they say that mallet fell by the hour. Dead simply because his neighbor had a cow go dry. Dead because he was born cross-eyed. Dead because of some old, deserted, forlorn person. He had gone out into the forest near the edge of a village, built a little hut, and maybe gave people a few herbs.
This.
For this he would be quite quickly killed, tortured, brought to the stake for a horrible crime. And of course, under torture, confessing anything because he couldn't stand the pain. So this situation moved over this whole area. It's still there today in the Balkans. But this situation and all the others pressing in gave us what I like to think of as the medieval world. A world which had to come to an end. A world in which crises developed from a hopeful 6th century to a hopeless 12th. And outside of the range of this European happening, in other areas, the rising of brilliant civilizations. Civilizations which Europe gradually became aware of. Civilizations which Europe had to copy. Had to bring back and restore all these things that had been lost. And so, the great hope, perhaps combining the hope for the rise of a Christian empire in Europe and the hope of a great reform in Asia through the rise of the Muslim empire, this hope grew strong. But by the 12th century, 600 years later exactly, both hopes had become forlorn. Both situations were again out of hand. And it remained essential that another great driving power be delivered. A new force would come into existence. Now this force dates perfectly with the transition that began what we might term the beginning of the modern world. And in the 12th century, all of these scattered inconsistent elements, in which there was much of good, much of hope, and much of sorrow, wisdom flowing from the great Muslim colleges, Buddhism spreading into China and Northern Asia, bringing its message of brotherhood, Christianity beginning to create its mysticism, for mysticism became the great remedy for this tremendous pressure. Because after all, Christendom consisted only of these same people. It wasn't a different people running them. They were the same people. And these people were beginning to recognize, whether layman or member of monastic order, that there was now only one hope, and that was to turn in again, to turn into self, in the great need of the consolation that only understanding of self could bring. Then we had the great Danse Macabre, the dance of death. We had the great cycles of penance. Men began to fear as they had never feared before. They feared for their own souls. They feared for everything. They believed finally that their whole world, the whole of Europe, was drenched in sin. It wasn't drenched in sin. It was simply drowning of ignorance. But they did not know the difference. They were not bad because they didn't know how to be good. They were just caught in a pattern that nothing seemed to break. And so over the mountains of Italy, France, Germany, and the Low Countries, over the landscape came these great processions. Processions of weeping, crying people. Hundreds of thousands moving every day. Processions the like of which we can have no concept. Women with babies clinging to their breasts, wandering along in the snow, falling dead, and wrapping the child to the end with their own bodies before they both froze. The roads, such as they were of Europe, red with blood from morning till night, from the feet of those wandering. Not because they had no homes, but because they had left everything from fear. Fear of sin. The sudden belief that the world was going to end and that all mankind was going to fall into perdition. Hell was going to swallow up Europe because Europe had sinned. And so we have the great processions of the flagellants, the penitents. We have the great sad mourn of the misericordia, the great howling, breaking of people. We find the prisons opened. the convicts coming out to strip themselves and beat their bodies, prince and commoner, queen and servant, walking barefoot in the snow, repenting their sins. So you can see that things were getting in pretty bad shape. And most historians have forgotten these things. But they lead inevitably from the great hope, the hope of Christendom, that the Christian Roman Empire would rise from the ashes of the Caesars, a phoenix. The great hope of Arabia, that the teachings of Muhammad would bring men back to God. The great hope of Asia, that education would save men. The great hope of our Western primitive empire, that men could live together in brotherhood and peace in the Maya states. All these hopes gradually declining. To declining in the Western Hemisphere, where upon the ruins of the old Mayan temples, the warlike Toltecs built their shrines. Every case, this great hope ending in darkness, ending in fear and doubt, and then at the critical moment, again, the resurrection of hope, the rising of the phoenix of human hope from the ashes of its own death in the brilliant burst of light that marked the 12th century. And that is the century we will talk about next week.